This is a download from the BBC. For details of our huge new range of audio for free download or podcast and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcast. Welcome to the World Book Club, where this month we've been reading a prize-winning comedy of culture clash called Nice Work. And here to answer questions about it from an invited audience and from BBC listeners around the world is its author, the British academic and novelist David Lodge. David Lodge, welcome to the World Book Club.
Thank you.
You're used to discussing other people's fiction in your role as a professor of English literature. Do you find talking about your own work easier or harder?
I suppose easier, because I do know it pretty intimately, whereas one's always afraid if you're talking about classics that you've forgotten something or make a mistake about it. But on the whole, I do forget my own books to some extent, but the more recent ones I feel fairly confident about. So it's easier, actually. And I think it's a kind of narcissistic pleasure, really, to talk about your own work.
Well, good. I hope you still think that in half an hour's time. David Lodge is a man of many talents. Besides being these days Emeritus Professor of English Literature at the University of Birmingham, he's written literary criticism, plays both for TV and theatre, and more than a dozen novels, of which the most recent, Death Sentence, was published earlier this year. Perhaps the most widely known of Lodge's fictions are his three so-called campus novels, Changing Places, Small World, and Nice Work, comedies he wrote in the 1970s and 80s about the intellectual, professional and sexual lives of academics that have been translated into more than 20 languages. In Nice Work, the main academic is a young woman called Robin Penrose, the possessor of a tastefully decorated house, a semi-detached boyfriend and impeccably progressive and feminist opinions. The fly in the ointment is that Robin's job as an English lecturer is being threatened by government cuts to education spending. Meanwhile, government policy on industry is what's bothering Vic Wilcox, the dogged, family-troubled MD of a local engineering firm. To Vic, the university is just a landmark on his worried way to work. Until, that is, a scheme to introduce academics to industrialists has Robin being sent to shadow Vic at his workplace. In all kinds of ways, neither has any idea what they're in for. To start with, Robin's idea of a factory is based on her reading of 19th century novels. "Where are the chimneys?" she asks when she arrives. And David Lodge, I wonder if you'd read a scene from Nice Work that comes shortly after that. It's where Robin and Vic have finally met, and Vic's been trying to interest Robin in the details of management structure.
Yes, I will. I should really read Vic's voice in a Midland accent, but it's not natural to me because I'm a Londoner in origin, so I'm not going to attempt it. I'm not an actor. "Do you know much about business?" Wilcox asked. "Nothing at all. But isn't that supposed to be the point?" "The point of the shadow scheme. It's just a PR stunt, if you ask me. You teach English literature, don't you?" "Yes." "What's that then? Shakespeare? Poetry?" "Well, I do teach a first year course that includes some." "We did Julius Caesar for O level," Wilcox interjected. "Had to learn great chunks of it by heart. Hated it, I did. The master was a toffee-nosed southerner. Used to make fun of our accents." "My field is a 19th century novel," said Robin, "and women's studies." "Women's studies?" Wilcox echoed with a frown. "What are they?" "Oh, women's writing, the representation of women in literature, feminist critical theory." Wilcox sniffed. "You give degrees for that?" It's one part of the course," said Robin stiffly. "It's an option." "A soft one, if you ask me," said Wilcox. "Still, I suppose it's all right for girls." "Boys take it too," said Robin, "and the reading load is very heavy, as a matter of fact." "Boys?" Wilcox curled a lip. "Nancy boys?" "Perfectly normal, decent, intelligent young men," said Robin, struggling to control her temper. "Why aren't they studying something useful, then?" "Like mechanical engineering?" "You said it,"
David Lodge, thank you very much for that. And we have a question about nice work now from Blanka Hemelikova in the Czech Republic, and she rang the World Book Club to ask this.
I am Blanka Hemelikova from Prague, the Czech Republic. I would like to ask Mr. Lodge, what's the proportion of fiction and the reality in the nice work? Was there, in reality, such a scheme between industry and university workers, such as the one which Vic Wilcox and Dr. Robin Penrose take part in, which he is describing in his novel? Thank you very much.
A charming voice and an interesting question. And the answer to it is that I originally conceived this book as being about a businessman who suddenly was deprived of his job. This was written in the mid-80s when there was a lot of unemployment at every level in the city of Birmingham, where I lived and worked. And I had a vague idea that he might meet a woman from the arts or the academic world. But I started with the idea of a man who was suddenly deprived of his job and was interested in exploring the experience of loss of employment, which was a very big theme at the time, and also was impinging on the university with the cuts imposed by Thatcher's government and the fact that most of our graduates had no prospect of getting a job when they graduated. So that was the sort of thematic material out of which the novel was to come. But when I started to think about the book, I thought, well, I have to know where this man comes from. What kind of work has he been doing before he got made redundant? And so I asked the husband of a mature student that I'd had, who himself was a managing director of an engineering firm in Birmingham or the Black Country just outside, if I could follow him about for a few weeks and observe his work. And he agreed, said, yeah, you can shadow me, and how will we explain it? And so we cooked up this idea that I was an academic using my sabbatical to investigate industry, because some of our graduates would go into management in industry, and I was curious to know what work was involved. That was the story. And it worked. I mean, only one person of all the many people we met recognised that I was a writer, a novelist. They all took my existence for granted. I was a fly on the wall, and it was just marvellous for me. But then, I mean, the more I got into this, the more I realised this was a fantastic plot device. And so I changed the story, really. Instead of being mainly about the man after he left the job or was pushed out, it was mainly about him being in the job, and the academia, the woman figure, became then a feminist lecturer who was a specialist on the industrial novel but knew nothing about industry, coming to shadow a man who knew nothing about literature and high culture. And both of them, however, lived for their work. And so that was how the novel evolved.
Well, now a question for David Lodge from the audience here at Bush House.
My name is Mei Li, and I'm from Hong Kong. I just wanted to know whether, if to any extent, you identify with either of your characters, if at all.
OK, that's also a good question. It's a very even-handed novel, or it's meant to be. A lot of my novels have a binary structure, but this one has a particularly strong binary structure. I mean, it just brings two totally different characters into collision, and the narrative switches from one to the other, sometimes within a scene, sometimes from one chapter to another. I think that more than most of my novels, it is independent of my own personal character. I mean, the two characters, one is a woman, a young woman, and the other is an industrialist, not very cultured. So neither of these two protagonists is very like me. She is an academic, and therefore the academic side of her life I could, you know, identify with. The Vic is more distant from me, and I am rather pleased with the novel in that I managed to create this character really has very little in common with me at all. And it was really the result, in a way, of doing this shadowing that I developed a kind of respect for the people I met in industry and in the management level, and got some sense of their commitment and their dedication, which was in its own way, was often as complete and almost obsessive as that of academics and scholars with theirs. So I don't think I wanted to favour one character over the other. I wanted to present them arguing. It was interesting to set them arguing to see where the argument would lead. And I'm rather fond of both of them.
Did you feel that David Lodge inhabited both characters equally?
Yeah, but I just wondered if maybe you might be a bit of a be in touch with your feminine side and have a bit of a feminist, you know, stance, or whether you didn't. That's all. I was quite interested in that.
We've got a question now from a BBC listener who was born in Iran to Iraqi parents and who now lives in Canada, so a fairly typical BBC World Service listener. She's Suad Sharabani, and she's in a studio now to ask her question.
Hello, hi.
Hello.
I have one little question. This novel exposes readers to the minds of industrialists, to the minds of middle management and academics, but never to the minds of workers, even though readers spend a great deal of time in the plant. Is that left for another book?
No, it's not left for another book. I think novelists' ability to empathise and with people and create characters must have its limits. I really wouldn't think of using a factory worker as my main point of view in a novel about this kind of theme, simply because I don't think I could make the character live. I don't think I could create, because without working in a factory for a year or two, I don't see how one could, and I'm not in a position to do that. So it is, yes, it's a middle class view of industry and of academia. And there is another novel to be written from the point of view of a tea lady at the university or a lathe operator at the factory. But it's not something I would feel able to do. One has one's limits. But, I mean, it's a perfectly valid question. And there are some good novels which have been written from the point of view of workers, but it's not something I could do.
So did you miss that, not having the point of view of the workers?
No, I was wondering, but I really respect this answer. I respect your answer.
Thank you.
It's a great answer.
There you are, respect. Another question now for David Lodge from the audience here at Bush House.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Shred from Northampton, Massachusetts, and I teach at Mount Holyoke College in Northampton. And I'll be researching at the Five College Women's Studies Research Center. I wish I had a short name. So I really am right in the midst of this. So my question was, so this is about a feminist, Robin Penrose. I wonder to what extent you might describe the novel as a feminist novel or not. And going back to Mei Ling's question about whether this was bringing out your feminine side.
Well, some people
theoretically.
Yeah, I mean, some readers, I think, have seen it as being rather satirical about feminism. Mm-hmm. I think that all my satire on academic life is actually based on reality. It doesn't travesty it. And the arguments that Robin puts forward in, say, analysing the Silk Cut advertisement are perfectly valid. Actually, it's a perfectly good piece of analysis. There is something potentially absurd about all interpretation. Academics rather solemnly often fail to realise that. And so it's fairly easy to make them amusing. And you only have to heighten things a little bit, tweak them a little bit to make them very amusing. I guess I'm of a generation that observed the effect of feminism that was, I mean, my marriage was based on a pre-feminist kind of ethos, and my wife was very typical of her generation. In the early 70s, she suddenly converted to feminism, and so were all her friends. And it seemed to me women became very much more interesting at that time as a result of this movement. And it, of course, had a big impact on university departments of literature, because most of the students were women, but they'd been taught by men, and they'd had a rather male-oriented, view of literary history. So it was intensely interesting and intellectually stimulating. And I wanted to represent that fairly in the character of Robin. At the same time, to by bringing her into this less than sympathetic environment, to make her see that it was, it's, you know, it wasn't an explanation for everything. That the, it, it was a rather, in some ways, limited point of view.
Thank you.
Good evening. I'm John Casey. I live in London. My question is, the advance notice given of Robin and Vic's affair in Frankfurt intrigued me. Could you comment on the thinking behind the explicit signposting of their fling?
Yes, that's right. The relevant chapter begins something like, on reflection, it was inevitable that Robin and Vic would end up in bed together at Frankfurt. This is what in the lit crit trade is known technically as prolepsis, where you anticipate you something that's going to happen. You give it away. And, of course, it's a very deliberate choice. And I did it because I thought one of the main problems of the novel was that really they had to have a sexual affair in terms of literary dynamics. On the other hand, it was quite difficult to make it plausible because they are so totally different. It was not hard to imagine Vic suddenly becoming sentimentally, romantically infatuated with this beautiful, vibrant young woman who'd come into his life. It was more difficult to imagine a girl like Robin wanting to go to bed with a man like Vic. And so, in a way, I was trying to anticipate the reader's possible scepticism about this actually happening. But once you just asserted that it was inevitable, and I gave a number of reasons in that paragraph why it was, why she was ripe to having a one-night stand, because her boyfriend had jilted her and she was generally rather fed up, and she was in a foreign country and it was, you know, nobody knew who she was impersonating somebody there. I mean, all kinds of factors which made it just possible that she would do it. And by feeding all that information into the reader, I hope then what did happen would be convincing.
I wonder if you'd read a passage now from Nice Work. It's where they are in Frankfurt, Robin and Vic. They're in their hotel.
Yes, and they. Robin has just dragged him off the dance floor and up to her hotel room. Robin opens the door of her room, hangs the Do Not Disturb sign on the outside and locks it from the inside. She kicks off her shoes, bringing her height down nearer to Vic's. He pushes her against the door and begins to kiss her violently, his hands clutching and groping all over her. Only passion, he feels, will carry him across the threshold of adultery. And this is what he supposes passion is like. Robin is surprised and a little alarmed by this behaviour. "Take it easy, Vic," she says breathlessly. "You don't have to tear the clothes off me." "Sorry," he says, desisting at once. His arms drop to his sides. He looks at her humbly. "I haven't done this before." "Oh, Vic," she says, "don't keep saying that. It's too sad." She goes to the minibar and peers inside. "Good," she says. "There's half a bottle of champagne. You don't have to do anything if you don't want to." "Oh, I want to," he says. "I love you." "Don't be silly," she says, handing him the bottle. "That song has gone to your head, the one about the power of love." "It's my favourite song," he says. "From now on, it will be our song." Robin can hardly believe her ears.
A question now for David Lodge from The Lady in the Pink Jacket.
I'm Jan Bild. I live in Berlin, where I organise intercultural reading groups in bookshops and libraries. I just happened to be fortunate enough to be in London to come to this evening. Members are mostly German, but people from 21 different countries take part. And in September, we've chosen to read Nice Work to link with the World Book Club, and we'll listen to this programme before we have our discussions. My question to David Lodge: why is Robin almost cruel to Vic after their fling?
Well, he is infatuated. He wants a permanent relationship. He's prepared to break up his marriage and his family, and that's the state of his infatuation. Robin is, as I said earlier, for her it was just an episode, a one-night stand, if you like, she's appalled at being drawn into an emotional relationship. So she's a fairly, incisive and at times abrasive sort of person anyway, with everybody. And so her way of dealing with this situation is to just try and shock him or shake him out of his romantic infatuation by being, rather cruel to him. Mm. Also, on sort of ideological grounds, she is distrustful of the whole idea of romantic love. I mean, she wants to deconstruct it, and so this seems a pathetic example of it. So she's trying to shake him out of that. I think that's why she, you might think, is rather cruel to him. But she's being cruel only to be kind, really.
Did you see them almost as switching roles, in that it's usually the man that has the one-night stand and walks away without any romantic involvement?
Very
much
so.
She's a feminist.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. Vic is actually a person who's, in terms of the erotic life, very immature. I mean, he's had no experience except with his wife, and that hasn't been terribly exciting. He has lived entirely for business, for making money and running factories and so on. So he's struggling with this new experience rather late in life.
First time he's ever felt passion, I assume.
Yes.
Your mind.
Yeah, but he's not, I mean, in some ways, he's not even quite sure that it is passion. I mean, he's acting a part again, really.
Thank you.
We have an email now from a BBC listener in Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. He's Kobizita Malusi Nkomo, and he writes this. Hello, David Lodge. Was there a specific message that you wanted to get across to the reader in this novel?
Well, I'm not a didactic novelist, the very fact that the novel is split between two different characters with utterly different sets of values and priorities, I think, and that I tried to hold the balance evenly between them, means that I'm not trying to convey any single message. I mean, if there is a message or moral to it, I mean, it would be something like that. All professions tend to have a tunnel vision of the world and to think their own professional interests are paramount and the most important thing, and to undervalue other kinds of approach to the world, other kinds of activity, other kinds of... but also that most people in the modern world actually do depend on satisfying work if they're to be happy. So work is important if it's creative and satisfying, but alienating if it's not. That possibly you can be too addicted to work. It can become a kind of fetish in itself.
A question for you, David Lodge, from Dr. David Parr Austin in Suffolk in Britain. He's emailed this. What would Robin be doing now? Would her life have changed significantly?
Well, I did introduce her into a later novel. She makes a fleeting appearance in a novel of mine called Thinks, which was published in 2001. And in the course of it, Robin Penrose makes a flying visit and gives a lecture of a deconstructionist kind. And we learn that she's become head of a department in a new university. That is the really new universities, one of these polytechnics, which has become a university. I think I called it Walsall University or something. And you get the impression that she's still unrepentantly feminist and deconstructionist, but she's become a bit of a tyrant in her own department. I mean, she's cracking the whip over these rather tired old polytechnic lecturers and making them publish so that they can meet their targets and get their money. And that, I meant to suggest, she might have learned from her immersion in industry and might have learned that from Vic Wilcox. She's also got a child, but no husband, no partner. I'll make an embarrassing confession. When I wrote that, I'd completely forgotten the ending of Nice Work, that she gives a lot of money to Vic Wilcox as an investment in his attempt to set up a firm of his own. I completely forgot to address that. Did she lose it all or did she make a lot of money? I've no idea. Nobody ever pointed this out, curiously enough. Nobody ever asked me. Now I've given it away to the world.
Well, that is all the questions we've got time for. Next month, we're off to Wyoming to the home of the American novelist Annie Proulx. She'll be talking about two works, her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Shipping News and her short story Brokeback Mountain. Do join us for that. And coming up on the BBC World Book Club, the St. Lucian Nobel laureate Derek Walcott will be answering questions about Omeros, his epic poem reimagining the ancient Greek story of the Odyssey in a Caribbean setting. If you'd like Derek Walcott to answer your question about Omeros on the programme, email him care of worldbookclub@bbc.co.uk. That's worldbookclub, all one word, at bbc.co.uk. Or you can text him by dialing your international access code followed by 44 77 86 20 60 60. 44 77 86 20 60 60. And please remember to tell him where you're writing from. For now, though, from me, Harriet Gilbert, and my producer, Karen Holden, thank you to all you members of the BBC World Book Club, whether listening at home or here at Bush House. And thanks especially to this month's guest, David Lodge. If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other BBC podcasts. To find out more and view the full range available, visit bbcworldservice.com/podcast.